something of the personal story, just a little, of the way that the Lord has led us in ministry in the UK, both in the local churches that we have served in and in our family life, could perhaps be of interest to you, you who are indeed a world away from us. Yet the wonderful thing is that in Christ Jesus, it doesn't matter where we live, we are all one. And just coming in today, we have felt really genuinely so much at home with you. We are genuinely brothers and sisters in the Lord. And isn't it wonderful that it doesn't matter who you meet, when we're Christians, we're all part of the same family. I hope to share at the women's rally the story of the church more, that the development that we've done in Cambridge. So I won't talk to you about that this afternoon because I don't want to overlap, hoping that some of you might be there. But I'd like to just talk to you and share with you, empathise with you perhaps, some of the stresses and strains in Mance life. Back in 1966, I was going through a very bad time. Traumatic, really, on many fronts. Not least of all was that my mother was in the last throes of dying with cancer. She and I lived alone since I hadn't had my father alive for many years. And the burden of nursing her while I was still a student fell on me. And at this particular low time, the Lord gave me some verses that have held me and have remained with me. And I sort of feel, you know how we all feel sometimes, that the Lord has given us a verse that stays with us right through life. We're often given many verses, but one that's really special to us. And I'd just like to share it with you this afternoon. And it's from Romans chapter 5, verses 1 to 5. And I'm sure you'll know it as soon as I begin. Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character. And character, hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God has poured out his love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, whom he has given us. Now, I didn't know what my husband was going to speak about this morning, but I feel that this probably follows on very nicely. I hope so anyway. One of the things about this reading are the two completely different kinds of rejoicing in it. The first rejoicing is easy. We rejoice in the peace that God has given us. And through faith, we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. There are wonderful words here. Now, I'm no theologian. In fact, I feel quite intimidated when there are ministers and theologians around. I don't know about you. But I was interested to hear a leading Baptist minister at home say that one of the biggest stresses that his wife felt was her lack of theological training. Well, I have that lack. But I do know something of these great words. Justified through faith. Peace with God. Access by faith. And into this grace, glory and hope. I hope that all of us here can know that kind of rejoicing. The Lord uses different things to attract us. Different things to attract us into the faith. For me, it was a Baptist church with a large youth club, with lots of good-looking boys. I hate that I was only 15 at the time, but when you're 15, that can be a really big attraction in getting you down to the church. I went one Saturday night with a friend, only to discover that there was an elderly deacon on the door barring the way. "I'm sorry," he said, "but this is not an open youth club." He said, "You have to be a member of the church to come here." Now, there were about 200 young people inside. It was a pretty lively youth group. Well, I was really disappointed. And I said to him, I went with a friend, and I remember saying to him, "Please, please let us in." You know, getting quite desperate now because some really good-looking boys had gone past us. And said, "Please, could you let us in? I promise to come back to the church tomorrow night." Now, I've always been the sort of person, if I make a promise or say something, I really have to do it. I can't, you know, my conscience won't let me let anyone down. But my friend didn't feel that. So she came in on my promise, but never went back the following night. But I had to. So off I went on my own, which was a pretty brave thing to do in a packed church, when you think about it. And I can't tell you now what on earth the minister said. I do know that I was sat in the gallery, and that the most extraordinary things were happening in front of me. People were being baptised. And I was truly not knowing a thing about baptism. I'd gone to a Methodist Sunday school in my youth. You know how you sort of kick your children out to get a bit of peace on a Sunday afternoon. But I'd never been to a Baptist church, never been to a baptismal service. And this I found truly amazing. And yet I didn't even realise that anything had happened until when the last candidate was being baptised. It was as if a voice spoke directly to me and said, "That's where you should be." I was absolutely amazed. Nothing like that had ever happened to me before. Well, the minister gave the appeal, and I didn't even know what that was about, really. But when I got to the church door on the way out, I did something very uncharacteristic for me. I burst into tears. And I'm not given to crying. I'm not one of these women who sort of cries a lot. But I was just led away and counselled. And before I knew it, I was in the baptismal class. Before I knew it, I was being baptised. And the wonderful thing was that my baptism, my own mother, was converted before she died, for which I really thank the Lord. Knowing now what I do, I'm so thankful that she died a Christian. It's given me so much peace. And 30 years later, I still feel this overwhelming sense of peace and thankfulness that Saturday night, that deacon broke the rules. It's so easy, isn't it, not to break the rules sometimes and think the church has got a rule on this, we must stick with it. Because if he had not let me in, I probably wouldn't be standing here in front of you now. That was a wonderful beginning and the story of God's grace and love. And it led, as I said, to my mother being baptised and being converted and then baptised. The hospital were very upset about this and didn't want her, thought it was too strenuous and too difficult, but two medical general practitioners were on the diaconate and assisted her throughout the service, and she was baptised. It was wonderful. I've always felt, since I lost my mother, about the church being a real family too, because in a sense, until I married my husband and had my own family, it was the only family I'd really got. And I really do feel this family feeling in the church, feel it very, very much. And I think then that when we know that we belong to this wonderful family, we cannot but help rejoice. Nothing is important for us all to look back and see the spiritual milestones in our lives and the causes for rejoicing and hope, because that can only be encouraging. But the second kind of rejoicing is very difficult. Verse 3. Not only so, but we also rejoice in our sufferings. Obviously, these verses were given in the sadness of my mother's story and are so appropriate in the dark times that ministry also can bring. The challenge is that suffering can actually benefit us. It can produce perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. It can turn us from being merely sympathisers into empathisers, and from being shallow people into deeper people. How many times have we gone through something and then been able to truly understand when another passes through? Not just sympathise, but really empathise, because we've been there first. Or suffering can make us bitter and cynical. And when to speak about rejoicing seems a cruel joke. To be honest, I have been on the borderline sometimes between the perseverance which produces character and hope and the absolute bitterness of despair. I suppose the worst moment as a minister's wife was nearly 3 years ago when my husband was struck down by a mystery illness and almost became quite disabled. It's hard to imagine that, isn't it, seeing him today and this morning. It was absolutely awful watching him suffer. The boys and I had to cut up his food because, like a toddler, he couldn't eat it properly. He had to lean against a wall to dress himself because he couldn't stand upright. He was It was just awful. I can't begin to describe to you unless you've been through watching someone else slowly lose the use of their limbs. I didn't know what to do. I thought, this Lord, it can't be happening. He's got so much to give. Things were happening in the church. The church is growing. We're building a Christian centre. What's happening? Is this spiritual attack? What is it? I was completely devastated at the thought that we might lose our home. We live in the manse. The church owns the car. They even own the cooker. I thought, what are we going to do if we have to move? I was really worried. And I thought, no, I've got to trust. I've got to have faith. The church and all our friends around the world are absolutely marvellous in prayer support. But to watch someone suffer and to hear the Cambridge consultant and later the London one say that he would have to give up work, that he'd probably never drive again, probably never do anything like that again, just in his early 40s, was a pretty devastating experience. Thank God that we didn't give up hope, that our prayers were answered, and although he isn't totally 100% healed, thanks to prayer, and believe it or not, poison, he's where he is today, because every 3 months he's injected in his neck, it's a dystonia disease, with the deadliest poison known to mankind, botulinum toxin. Now a file that size would wipe out 8 to 10 million people living in London overnight if it was put in the drinking water. And yet they inject this into people, in their neck, in their eyes, when some people have got a dystonia in the eyes and they can't see because the eyelids keep shutting. All sorts of things like this. It's absolutely wonderful that something that was potentially so evil can be put to so much good. Yet I rejoice that there are scientists and there are doctors and there are people who can do such wonderful things, and that the Lord has given us things that can be used for good. And I feel that this, in this context, the suffering of, actually mental suffering of watching someone else physically suffer, and I'm sure lots of us have been there. There are so many other strains in the manse that it's very hard sometimes to rejoice over. We're twinned in our church with a twin church in Oradea, Romania. And for 5 years we have been a sister church to them. We've sent food parcels, we've given prayer support, we've sent ambassadors over to visit. And of course, like the rest of the world, we rejoiced at Christmas when Ceausescu and that awful regime toppled. And since then we've had some of their people visiting our church. Things are still very, very difficult in Romania, and in some ways even more difficult for the Christians. But how much they suffered, how much they had to be denied, they were denied under that awful regime, put our suffering into context. And on the personal level, I feel that sometimes it's very, very hard. You've heard a bit that we have two teenagers. When one of them is rebelling, or maybe both of them, or four of them if you've got four, perhaps against the church, against your husband's job, against everyone else, it's very hard to rejoice in that, and it's very hard to bear. There have been times when I've nearly been in tears over Simon, our elder boy's behaviour, and just wondered where it's all going to go. He's driven me nearly batty for 2 years, and now at the end of the month we have to take him down to London to begin college. And I think I'm going to be so moved to see him go. It's going to be really hard. I've been dying for him to go for about 12 months. Now it's actually coming. And you know, the other day, I really was nearly moved. He put his arm around me and said, well, Mum, he said, I think when I've gone to college, you know, he said, I'm going to realise just how great you really are. I was so moved that he should say something like that. But it's very hard, isn't it, to rejoice that your child is actually rejecting all that you stand for. And we just have to pray and pray and keep loving. The other thing I find it very hard to rejoice in sometimes is the fact that perhaps people criticise one's husband. Now you know, and I know, that usually it's totally unjustified. That person that's criticised doesn't know the half. They don't know that your husband's been up since 7 o'clock in the morning, didn't get home till 11:30 at night, and hasn't stopped all day. He's been trying to do X, Y and Z and fill in a bit in between. And you feel like standing up and screaming out, look here, just because he didn't get to visit you, it doesn't mean today wasn't working. You know, they don't understand. And you feel so hurt and almost in despair, you know. I'm sure some of you are smiling and nodding. You've been there. I understand too. And that relentless draining of our energy when we genuinely seek to serve, to visit, or whatever it is we do in our joint ministry. And people perhaps don't understand, or they don't think you're doing enough, or they think you should be doing this and not that. Very hard to rejoice when people do seem in the churches to be critical. And I know that I have said sometimes, if I wasn't a Christian already, that person's behaviour certainly wouldn't convert me. Very hard sometimes to take. And the expectations, as I said, that we just can't fulfil because the Lord hasn't given us that particular gift, perhaps. And people think perhaps we should be up there speaking all the time at the front, but that isn't our gift. So many ministers' wives in England, it seems to be part of the old-fashioned concept, shall we say, that the minister's wife must be president of the women's afternoon meeting. She must chair the meeting, she must speak at the meeting, and so on. But some ministers' wives just can't do that. It's not their gift. And I have also felt very strongly, we have missionaries here with us this afternoon. We had an uncle, I know Michael won't mind me saying this, but Uncle John was a dear soul, went off to Bangladesh with the Baptist Missionary Society. When he got home, they insisted that he go on deputation. And they put him in our Baptist Missionary Society youth camps. Now, Uncle John is a bachelor who had many friends, but never quite made it to the altar, if you know what I mean. A very shy fella. He's a 60-something now, but dear Uncle John. And he would kill anybody's interest in missions stone dead. He had not got the gift of communication. And these poor young people subjected, and churches, to his going around, I think was a travesty, really. It would have been better to send someone based at home who'd got the gift of communication. But you know what I'm saying, don't you? These expectations, we can't always fulfil them because that just isn't what we're meant to be doing. And maybe some of you have been through times of caring, perhaps for an elderly relative or for a seriously ill child. Back in 1983, our youngest son was discovered to be seriously ill. He was then 8, he's now 15. And it was a devastating time for us then when Robert was found to have a huge blood clot on his head, an aneurysm. When they operated, they thought it was just a simple fracture of the skull, but when they operated, they discovered that Robert, in fact, had got this aneurysm with a paper-thin skull underneath. And we are eternally grateful to the surgeon who saved him. I mean, he's marvellous now, and we're very grateful, but trying to cope with a seriously ill child in the hospital day after day, while the church expected my husband to carry on with the ministry, I wanted him beside me. These sort of things are very hard, aren't they? And you ask yourself, how can I rejoice in this, Lord? What are you trying to teach me? Well, I just don't want to go on all afternoon. I don't want to bore you, but I do think that the Lord can teach us a lot through these times of misunderstandings, of stress. He can teach us, as it says in Romans 5, that when we persevere, we carry on, we don't lose our faith. When we have hope, we will win through. And I'm a testimony to that this afternoon, and Michael is too, that we didn't give up hope. He is able to minister, I'm able to be with him. And I really would commend those words to you. When you in your man's situation find life sometimes just a bit too hard, perhaps spiritual attack a little bit too hard to cope with, turn to Romans 5. Maybe you have your own particular verse, but there are so many verses in the Bible that can comfort us and uphold us. But what I'd say to you is, don't give up. Have that perseverance, have that character, and keep that hope that is the gift of God. Now, I'm very happy to answer any questions. I didn't want to go on too long. And Michael says, if there's any theological ones, he'll answer those.
Ladies, if you have any questions, would you please come to one of the microphones so that everyone can hear?
Well, Michael's actually on the Baptist Union Council, so I'll let him handle this one.
Do you know, it's been really good to sit down and to listen to you. It has. I haven't done that for such a long time. Yes, in terms of the way in which the Baptist Union works in Britain, we have, of course, because we're in the cauldron of all the history, still some very strange historical happenings, because the particular Baptists and the general Baptists, which were two different streams, and those of you interested in Baptist church history will know that those two streams partly came together but partly remained separate. And the Baptist Union, which has within it something like, well, it's well over 2,000 churches and something like a quarter of a million members, also has alongside it something called, well, it was the Strict Baptist Union. It's now been renamed the Grace Baptist Union, which is reformed and totally Calvinistic and rather separate. So in a place like Cambridge, where we minister, we have a city of 110,000 people. We have seven Baptist Union churches, of which ours is the oldest one in the centre. There is one Strict Baptist Church, a Grace Baptist Church, which is a very, very powerful and effective preaching centre. And then, very interestingly, there are a whole lot of independent evangelical churches which have grown, of which the most phenomenal happening is the what they call the Church House movement, the Restoration movement, which of course doesn't meet anymore in houses because many of the fellowships are of so many hundreds in size that they often take over the largest centre in a city. And when we get back to Cambridge, we shall have the joy, in inverted commas, of having next door to us on the main street in Cambridge, in the only cinema in the city, very big cinema, the Cambridge Community Church, which is just beginning this September, because they've run out of space, they've taken over the largest school in the city, their congregations are 700-800, and they want to have a lot of space, and so they've now moved into the cinema next door to us. Now, we have good relationships with them, though we happen also to have lost some of our very gifted people and some of the young people who've come to faith and I've baptised, who've said to us, sometimes gracefully and sometimes not, that they now feel they've moved on and they're now leaving our church in order to be members of a community church. So when we get back, we shall have this extraordinary business. We're right in the centre and we have a big car park belonging to our telecom service that we use. They've been given permission to use the university car park, and we shall have all these hundreds of people. And our two doors are very close. I mean, they couldn't be closer as they some come into us and some go into them. When I share this with my deacons, they said, well, of course, some people might get so confused they come into us by mistake. but that's the kind of system. And of course, we, like you, have the structuring of, we have 12 areas, each area has a superintendent. I'm afraid we are far, far less equipped, it seems to me, than many of you are in Australia, in terms of a backup and the executive staff. And that's something that we've got to work hard at, because many British Baptists, I regret to say, are very, very parochially based, spend a lot of their energies on their local church, some of which of course can be very strong, but as soon as you move to association life and area life, it gets weaker and weaker. And I regret, I'm going to have to keep banging that drum, but we do owe a tremendous responsibility to brothers and sisters in our areas and much beyond. But that's a little bit of a picture, I think.
Lots of friends there who eventually come back have said, when you just wouldn't know England anymore, it's changed so dramatically in these last years. And I suppose because of the different nationalities, like Australia, it's getting that one year too, that have come into England. But in our Christian magazines, we read a lot about the inroads of Islam in England. Could you give us some idea of how the church is coping with that?
Certainly in the north of England we have a very large immigrant population, Pakistani, Indian, Bangladeshi, And of course it's very common to see lots of mosques. And what is even sadder, I feel sometimes, it's a converted church gone into a mosque. And of course the imam, you see them on the street with the little children, you know, they go for hours after school, these Muslim children, for religious instruction and language training in their own language. And it's very hard, I think, to see that the Muslim parents take their responsibilities to their children seemingly much more seriously than the average English person does to their child when it comes to any sort of religious training. Some of the churches in the Yorkshire Association, where a lot of the Muslim immigrants are, have actually appointed a church worker to work amongst immigrants, amongst the Muslim, almost, if you like, a missionary in the north. And that happened, didn't it? Oh, and Birmingham is another area, and of course London is also very heavily immigrant. There are other pockets too, but that's where they tend to be. Certainly every shop, you know, every street, you'd think you're in Little India or whatever. That's true, isn't it? But I think on the whole, we have not woken up to the fact that the certainly every shop, you know, every street, you'd think you're in Little India or whatever. That's true, isn't it? But I think on the whole, we have not woken up to the fact that the Islamic message is being passed along much quicker than we are doing it as Christians. In the schools, the children don't learn Christianity anymore. In our schools, it's comparative religion, which means they do Hinduism and Islam and, most of the world's religions. They have a lot of television programs for schools during the day, and the religious ones, you're much, much more likely to see an Indian festival portrayed than a Christian one. Much more likely. And when our own two were in infant and junior school, we were horrified. They knew all about Islam, but they didn't bother teaching anything about Christianity. It's almost negating Christianity, because now we're a multiracial, multi-ethnic society. We've got to, you know, be open. We're so open now, we forget our own Christian roots. At least that's my feeling. And it's a very worrying trend in Britain that the Islamic message, the humanistic message, whatever, will be pushed much, much more than the Christian message if there's nobody dynamic enough there to do it. It's the same in Australia, is it? It's sad, isn't it? Because they seem to get their act together and we're not. And I feel this is really sad. And when we're bringing up our children to understand more about festivals, you know, in other countries, well, under their noses as well, and not telling them about their own roots and their own Christian heritage, I feel we're failing badly. And, well, we all know the consequences of that. No, I don't think so. Not from my own experience, from what I've seen. It tends to be just the Muslim families. But you do get situations, you see. We ministered in Lancashire for 7.5 years in the north of England. And there are several Church of England schools. Do you have those here? You know, the schools that are church, like Catholic schools and so on. Church of England schools, which are 100% immigrant. 100% Islam. So the kids there would be celebrating Christmas and whatever the New Year is for, you know, and so on. They celebrate all the festivals, whether they're Christian or not. And the parents tolerate it as a cultural thing rather than as a religious activity. Because they're living in England, they've got to know that we celebrate Christmas or whatever. But it's done very carefully by the teachers. But it's very difficult when you've got 100% immigrant children, not one English child in the class. Okay, I think we're on time. Just half a minute.
Yes. Carol just said we've got a half a minute before we hear the pitter-patter of the men outside. Right. Well, thank you very much for that. If you have any further questions to ask, I'm sure they'd be willing to talk to you later. But before we go, Margaret Halsey has a little duty to perform. Thank you, Margaret.
glad you're both up here, because what I've got here is something for you both, I think. And I found out just 2 days ago that you had two boys, so stuck on the front here are a couple of bookmarks, one each for the boys. It's very Australian, wrapped in Queensland wrapping paper, so that you can take it home and show that you've been here. And we hope that you'll like the contents. Nobody has seen them, so if you want to open it, you can.
You
always
see
them. And you may as well have it.
Oh, they're beautiful. Yes, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, it's lovely. Thank you very, very much. Discovering Australia's wildlife. I don't want to discover too much of it. I understand you've got snakes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.